destroys their crops. On the other hand, Thiazi is the evil storm giant who blasts you with lightning and destroys your crops with his floods. In short, Thor and Thiazi here represent the positive and negative aspects of the same phenomenon. The Greeks made the same distinction between beneficent gods living on Mount Olympus and evil giants chained underground for their transgressions. Interestingly, the gods in the frigid north emerge as much gloomier and more aware of their own potential doom than the cheerful gods of the south, while the northern giants cause mayhem on a far more frequent schedule than those of the sunny south. Each analogy has its frame of reference, its viewpoint. The Frankfurts remark that the myth user wants to find a cause as specific and individual as the event which it must explain. Since he does not isolate an event from its attending circumstances, he does not look for one single explanation which must hold good under all conditions. Death, considered with some detachment as a state of being, is viewed as a substance inherent in all who are dead or about to die. But death considered emotionally is the act of hostile will. Thus, the traditional vampires of Europe revealed their presence by willfully causing the deaths of their fellow villagers. If everyone was getting sick and dying, a vampire must have a grudge against the village. But at the same time, death was viewed as something one could catch from others simply by getting too close. Old women had to wash and dress the dead. If they caught death, too bad. Society would still survive. Because a phenomenon may have so many aspects, modern scholars of myth in particular, and of ancient cultures in general, do well to cultivate as a working method the knack of dollying their mental camera around to as many different viewpoints as possible. Until we see what the mythmakers are looking at on this particular occasion, from their point of view or camera angle, it may be impossible to understand what they are talking about. We'll refer to this powerful method as solving the camera angle problem. To understand what a story is talking about, we may have to observe the situation from a very particular viewpoint. Linguists studying language acquisition in children often report this phenomenon. Until you see what baby is looking at, you can't understand what baby is trying to communicate. To interpret a toddler's declaration, "Mommy! Sock!" You need to know whether the child is looking at its own feet, or at mommy's feet, or diving into the laundry basket. The child's gaze silently provides all that context for interpretation that adults learn to encode into the utterance itself. In mythology, to understand what, let's say, the Egyptians talk about, you have to see what the Egyptians saw. We had to get into our viewfinder the Egyptian sources of their all-important mortuary supplies to see how Isis might find Osiris inside a tree at Byblos. To understand why Ptah's creation of the universe takes place on a primeval mound of mud that differentiates itself from the waters of chaos, we have to focus on what the Egyptians saw when the all-covering Nile floodwaters began to recede each year. The tip of a mound of mud here, then one there, growing in size until the whole land of Egypt gradually reappeared, completely refertilized and ready to bear new life-giving crops. Life to the Egyptian began each year with and on those mounds. Some have suggested that the shape of the pyramids constitutes a geometric analog of the primeval mound of mud. Hilda Davidson posits a camera angle solution to the origin of Odin's eight-legged horse, Sleipnir. Odin included among his duties the receiving of the dead, so Davidson places her camera to watch the bier on which a dead man is carried in the funeral procession by four bearers. Borne along thus, he may be described as riding on a steed with eight legs. Confirmation of this is found in a funeral dirge recorded by Verrier Elwin among the Gonds in India. It contains references to Bagri Maro, the horse with eight legs, and it is clear from the song that this is the dead man's beer. One verse of it runs, "What horse is this? It is the horse Bagri Maro. What should we say of its legs? This horse has 8 legs. What should we say of its heads? This horse has 4 heads. Catch the bridle and mount the horse." The representation of Odin's 8-legged steed could arise naturally out of such an image, and this is in accordance with the picture of Sleipnir as a horse that could bear its rider to the land of the dead. Noting the pairs of horses sometimes found in the entryways of Mycenaean Greek tombs, one may wonder if this conception of the 8-legged steed carrying the dead goes back to earlier Indo-European times. Mott Green, too, in his perceptive book, Natural Knowledge in Preclassical Antiquity, notices the effects of camera angle, for example in his essay on Egyptian fractions. He points out that whereas our mathematical efforts move toward finding the most general solution to the use of numbers, the Egyptians had no concept of numbers in abstraction from things numbered. Instead, both numbering and fractions constituted direct ways of dealing with material goods, such as divvying the available loaves of bread and jugs of beer among the workmen, or quarrying appropriate blocks of stone for a job, a purely practical measurement of quantities, areas, and volumes. To understand why the Egyptians never moved beyond their seemingly cumbersome system of unit fractions, Green demonstrates, we need to see what problems they were looking at. We need to see the world from their camera angle. In fact, after tackling several more problems that have baffled scholars because they had inappropriate camera angles, we'll see more of this in Chapter 8, Green concludes, there is a wisdom in assuming that the people whose works one studies, such as myths and other literature, are fully capable of describing their world, and that one is obliged to make that assumption at the very least until one knows enough about that world to assay what they said about it. In other words, the onus is on us to find the appropriate position from which to assess their reports, rather than simply dismissing the reports as empty, like a deaf man dismissing the phenomenon of sound as an old wives' tale. If we have become deaf, we must strive to build a sound spectrograph, just as we have built devices to show the presence of light waves beyond our range of vision. The principle of multiple aspects creates some curious eddies around it. Because a phenomenon may be broken up into as many pieces as it has significantly different aspects, and because different cultures have different camera angles, we may find that pieces do not match well from one culture to the next. We see this effect all the time in cross-linguistic studies, as in the famous example of the rainbow. To speakers of English, this spectrum clearly consists of 6 colors: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet. Except, of course, for folks who insist on a 7th color, indigo, between blue and violet. So which is it? 6 colors or 7? Neither, and both, and anything else you please. Physicists assure us that the visible spectrum, the rainbow, consists of an even gradation of electromagnetic wavelengths from the longest, red, to the shortest, violet, that we can see. So any divisions we make are all in our heads. If we already find cultural variation within English, the variations beyond it proliferate almost limitlessly. We perceive color via cones in the back of the eye that react at peak to different wavelengths. Physiologists find that our brains, too, peak in their reactions to certain sectors of visible light. These findings of how our heads work explain some of the cross-cultural correlations that we find, but still do not entirely explain a rainbow cut into, say, 6 pieces as in English. Much remains culturally arbitrary. The classical Greeks, for instance, saw the spectrum of colors in 5 basic units, not 6, and not spread linearly across the wavelengths, but largely split between light and dark, as in many languages. One could lay out their terms graphically, with the red end of the spectrum at the left and the violet end at right. On the left is erythros, ruddy. To the right and above, chloros, pale yellow and green. To the right of that, glaucos, pale blue, lavender, and gray. Below chloros would be xanthos, tawny. To the right of that, kianos, dark green, blue, and purple. Thus, erythros, cognate with English red, and from which we borrowed erythrocyte, red blood cell, denotes colors at the red end of the spectrum. As in Balkan folk dress, it seems to lump what we would call bright orange and deep pink together with red. From there on, pale is distinguished from dark or intense. Thus, chloros, whence English chlorophyll, refers to all those pale yellow to green colors you see in the grass when you lift a brick lying on it for days. Whereas glaucos, borrowed in English glaucoma, encompasses the remaining pale colors, seen in sky and mist, light blue and lavender shading off into gray. So there is no need to translate Homer's epithet, Glaucopes Athene, as gray-eyed Athena. She could perfectly well be blue-eyed. The dark side, on the other hand, breaks the spectrum not between our green and blue, as the light side does, but between green and yellow. Thus, xanthos covers the tawny yellows plus light brown, while kianos, whence English cyanide, refers to dark green, dark blue, and purple. And suddenly, our camera attains the proper angle to see why Homer can refer to the wine-dark sea. The dark blue-green of the ocean, as we see things, falls into the same color box for the Greeks as dark purpley-red wine. Such non-matching divisions weigh heavily for the argument that traditional literature, like poetry, and like the prose of great stylists, simply cannot be translated into another language without major loss of content. You can explain till you're purple, but the instant recognition of deep-seated relationships and structure cannot be re-achieved. Robert Frost encapsulated it by saying, "Poetry is what gets lost in translation." While Joshua Katz has pointed out to us an interesting discussion of this problem by Stephanie Jameson that he dubs the Goldilocks principle. The word porridge is a fairly rare one for the American English speakers, and for most of us, however long removed from childhood, it has one strong semantic association. This single word, no matter what context we hear it in, can instantly evoke the whole narrative complex of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, the bowls of steaming porridge, the messy beds. The word oatmeal, on the other hand, does not. Alertness to the different associational ranges of two apparent synonyms can give a window on the cultural knowledge of the speakers who have these unconscious distinctions. But marginal vocabulary is not the only source of this knowledge. The same instant access to the same narrative is given by the perfectly well-formed, syntactically uninteresting English sentence, "Who's been sleeping in my bed?" Formulaic language of this sort binds a speech community with invisible semantic fetters. From Jameson, 1996. But the next language will not have the same bindings. Phenomena such as these have led us to call the incommensurateness in how people divide and label things the rainbow corollary. Different peoples divide up the same world differently, as they fasten onto different aspects within the multiplicity. Consider water. We view it simply as H2O. But the Hawaiians distinguish wai, sweet water, from kai, salt water, and kai, the shallow ocean near the shore, from mona, deep sea, the line between turquoise kai and lapis mona being sharply evident to the eye. The Mesopotamians, for their part, divided water into the sweet waters that spring from the earth, apsu, the salty sea, tiamat, storm waters that pelt us from above, Enlil, and water as a generative agent, Enki. The early Indo-Europeans, living as they did in the vast, landlocked expanses of Western Eurasia, seem to have centered their notions of water on storms and great rivers, both of which abound in that area, without much regard for the ocean. Or so we gather from the comparative reconstructions of both their vocabulary and their myths. Thus, the daughter cultures typically have as one of their top deities a lightning-wielding god of storm clouds, such as Roman Jupiter, Greek Zeus, Indic Indra, Germanic Thor, or Slavic Perun, and another, often his brother, who presides over bodies of water, for example, Roman Neptune, Greek Poseidon, a hybrid character, as we have seen, Indic Apaim Napate, and probably Irish Nectan. The Egyptians, however, experienced all water as coming from the Nile. Rain did not fall in Egypt. So those foreign countries not watered directly by the Nile simply had their Nile above them, a view of rain that most of us would not recognize readily. A hymn to Aten states, "Thou makest that whereon all distant countries live. Thou hast put another Nile in the sky, so that it may come down for them in order to moisten their fields." These Niles, in turn, flowed from Nun, the primordial waters out of which life first issued, which continued both to flow under the platter-shaped earth and to encircle it as the sea. The sheer multiplicity of divine principles available to be worshipped often leads to a further perturbation of the picture. If two cultures become closely familiar with each other's religions, thanks to invasion or intense trade, people begin to see yet more aspects of the world than before, aspects which their new acquaintances view as willful and hence potentially dangerous if slighted. Prudence suggests that one adopt these new divinities. We wouldn't want to offend a deity, now would we? As Pindar says, "It is proper for men to speak only good about the gods, for there is less blame that way." Hedging your bets. If someone else is worshipping a different, willful aspect than you, add or graft it onto your pantheon to be safe. The Romans, for example, adopted the Egyptian cult of Isis, and the people of late classical Crete borrowed the Egyptian cult of Nofert, which presently got Christianized as Saint Onofrios, or Onofre. Examples of hedging abound among people barely converted to Christianity. Russian ethnographers working in remote parts of Siberia in the 20th century often commented on seeing Christian icons inside a nomad's tent set up right beside non-Christian idols or shamanistic equipment. But a millennium earlier, the missionaries and priests trying to convert the Slavs to Christianity complained of the identical thing in Russian huts. The Russians even coined a term for it, devovery, double belief. Evidence for double belief permeates the mythologies of Europe. Long before Christianity, the Indo-Europeans had perfectly good water gods, within a pantheon representing life as they knew it on the steppes. But when that branch we know as the Greeks arrived in Greece and settled among the local Aegean populace, who had their own full pantheon mirroring life as they knew it in the Aegean, the Greeks clearly discovered that their deities did not cover quite everything. One important omission was tsunamis. Earthquakes they already knew. Giants chained to the earth caused quakes. Age-old giants like Prometheus, who has a good Indo-European name. But killer tidal waves were new. So they grafted what was apparently a local god, Poseidon, in charge of both quakes and giant ocean waves, into their pantheon, where our comparisons would lead us to expect the linguistic and functional equivalent of Neptune, Apaim Napate, Lord of Waters. Athena was also grafted in. Her name is non-Indo-European, and her function superfluous. She wields the lightning? Zeus already does that. in charge of war? The Greeks already had a perfectly good war god, and a culturally more appropriate male at that, Ares, whose name probably connects etymologically with the Iranian word for an elite warrior band, Arye, Aryan, center of early Indo-European society, and with the Greek word best, aristos, whence our word aristocracy borrowed straight from Greek. Men dominated Indo-European society from top to bottom. So why this uppity goddess? Evidence shows clearly that many early Aegean groups organized themselves matrilineally, with all inheritance, including kingship, coming down through the female line. We'll see more of this in Chapter 13. We even have one matrilineal law code preserved from early classical Crete, a Minoan holdover. If infiltrating Greeks wished to live in Athens, the city that traditionally belonged to Athena, they had better find some way to graft her into their pantheon, and a politic way at that. Fine. Make her Zeus's favorite daughter, born straight from his head without a mother, sharing his magisterial traits as a precocious and indulged offspring. From just the right camera angle, Athena makes sense. Note that any time we find two deities in a single culture who seem to have the same purview, we do well to suspect grafting from elsewhere. Take Prometheus, whose name is Indo-European. He was a giant, evil, who, like Loki, hung around with the gods, good, and did humankind the signal service of bringing them fire and teaching them all manner of crafts, such as the fiery forging of metals. As such, he became the divine overseer of crafts and metalworking. The gods did not take kindly to the stealing of fire, of course, reasoning, movie construct, that it made humans more nearly like gods, so they punished Prometheus by fastening him to a mountain and setting an eagle to peck at him. But the Greeks had a second god of crafts and smithing, Hephaestus, whose forge lay inside Mount Etna. You could see the smoke and sparks when he was at work. Everything points to Hephaestus as a late graft into Greek lore from another, clearly Mediterranean culture. Even his name has no Greek etymology. As so often, a strongly parallel phenomenon exists in language, and this method of investigating doublets has proved tremendously fruitful in archaeolinguistics. To see how this works, consider the masses of double vocabulary in English that resulted from 3 centuries of French-speaking overlords in England after the Norman conquest of AD 1066. The Anglo-Saxon underling lived in a room and sweated as he ate after feeding the cows, sheep, and swine, whereas the nobleman inhabited a chamber and perspired as he dined on beef, mutton, and pork. The peasant's words and the grammar come straight from Proto-Indo-European through 5,000 years of sound changes, or at least from Proto-Germanic 2,000 years back, whereas milord's terms, still mostly with upper-class connotations even today, got grafted into English from French, just the way Hephaestus and Athena got grafted into the Greek pantheon. Now take a prehistoric example. Ancient Greek textile vocabulary overflows with pairs of words for the same or nearly the same things, one term having an Indo-European etymology and the other not. The Indo-European terms prove sufficient only for the equipment of a simple band loom, whereas the additional words necessary for operating the large warp-weighted loom are all borrowed, and we find 2 words each, one Indo-European, one not, for most of the tools and operations necessary for simple band weaving, warp, weft, weave, bead in, and thread preparation, spin, spindle, thread, sew, needle, etc. This matches the archaeological record. The warp-weighted loom and its use developed into a sophisticated craft in a specific area of south-central Europe in the early Neolithic, long before the Indo-Europeans broke apart, and this loom never spread east of the Dnieper River. So we must conclude that the Greeks moved into this textile-rich culture from the east and borrowed the more sophisticated craft, words and all, just as they borrowed Athena, goddess of weaving. The trick is to spot the telltale signs of such mergings and turn them to account in reconstructing the past using the doublet clue. Double terminology or doublets within a belief system, especially en masse, indicate that one culture has absorbed another culture and or changed its environment or technology. The doublets can be milked accordingly for information about the former natures of these cultures and the changes that occurred. Syncretism, a form of doubling, happens all the time all over the world. The ancient Slavs clearly took over deities like Simargal from the Iranians, bolstering their own panoply of fertility spirits, while the early Norse tribes apparently doubled their pantheon by adding the somewhat hazy Vanir, fertility gods perhaps of earlier farmers in the area, to the sharply defined Æsir, a second race of gods that included Thor, Odin, and other Indo-European types. According to the myths, the Æsir vanquished and absorbed the Vanir after much fighting. Hilda Davidson, in her careful summary of Norse mythology, puzzles that we have the strange double of Odin, the god Od, who is said to have been Freya's husband, for whom she wept after he left her. Now, Odin and his wife Frigg belong to the Æsir, whereas Od, apparently a dying god so common in fertility cults, and Freya belong to the Vanir. Freya and Frigg, like Od and Odin, are also doublets, both goddesses having to do with procreation and childbirth. The clear etymological connection in both pairs of names suggests that those earlier farmers were fellow Germanic speakers of a different or perhaps lost dialect group. Deleting deities from the pantheon, on the other hand, causes far more trouble than adding or grafting, although for the same reason, fear of offending divine powers. Thus, when Socrates appeared to advocate the position that there was one divine principle instead of a bunch of silly gods seducing each other, stealing, and having other undignified adventures, he was sentenced to death as too dangerous to the community. Similarly, Christians advocating the Trinity have repeatedly branded as heretics those Christians who maintain the unity of God. Before that, the Romans persecuted the monotheistic Christians for failing to pay homage to the vast Roman pantheon. Long before any of these, the Egyptian New Kingdom pharaoh Akhenaten declared that the Aten, sun disk, was the sole god of the universe, thereby ousting the traditional throng of Egyptian deities. Upon his death, the priests of Amun-Ra reinstated the old religion, systematically destroyed Akhenaten's monuments, and expunged the heretic king's name from the records, thereby attempting to destroy the immortality due a pharaoh, and perhaps to placate the gods he had demoted. Heretic syndrome. Treat as heretics those who wish to reduce the pantheon. It threatens your security. Even taking away part of God's perceived domain can raise the alarm, as Galileo found to his distress when he showed evidence that Earth was not the center of the universe. Another little eddy spawned by hedging one's bets involves what William Sullivan aptly terms guerrilla syncretism. This occurs when one culture is forced to swallow the religion of another and resorts to subterfuge. Sullivan elaborates. Because Spanish churchmen meted out severe punishment, up to and including death, for unrepentant adherence to the old ways, the Andean peoples quickly learned to take on the appearance of piety while continuing, to the extent possible, exactly as they had done before. One such example transpired on the eve of All Souls' Day, Halloween. In Inca times, the ancestors were thought to return annually to Earth, and this festival was celebrated at the December solstice. The custom was to provide food and drink, thus maintaining the correct relationship with the ancestors. The peasantry, recognizing the pagan roots of a Christian custom, had taken to propitiating the ancestors on the day allotted to the ancestors in the Christian liturgical calendar. To this day in Mexico and Peru, native peoples bring a picnic dinner to the cemetery on All Hallows' Eve, waiting for the dawn and the return of the dead. From Sullivan, 1996. It is known as Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. Ironically, even the people of Rome had been loath to give up their ancient household protectors, the Lares and the Penates, when first Christianized, and they syncretized them into a system of patron saints still extant today. East Slavs acted similarly. Instead of giving up their old belief system, they merely renamed their divinities with seemingly Christian names and kept on as before. Thus, the storm god Perun stepped into the persona of the biblical prophet Elijah, associated with whirlwinds, while the midsummer festival that involved jumping into lakes for a midnight swim, plus a lot else during the night, became the festival of John the Baptist. John the Bather, Ivan Kupala. Even in the 20th century, rural farmers in such places as Bulgaria and Ukraine, who considered themselves Christians, continued to carry out flatly pagan fertility rituals, such as the winter, spring, and summer Rusalii, adjusted slightly to fit the calendar of the church. As recently as 1993, in the newly reopened cathedral in Kiev, we saw ritual towels embroidered with symbols of fertility and protection, symbols traceable directly back to the Neolithic, freshly tied to the brass rails around the saints' coffins. For centuries, such non-Christian towels decorated the Christian icons in the icon corner of the farmhouse, and at a wedding, the groom and his bride sat appropriately under the icons of the Savior and the Mother of God, for protection and, yes, fertility, a case of guerrilla syncretism with archaic pagan images of male and female. The faces and names changed, but the purposes lived on. For such crucial projects as fertility and protection, however, the multiplicity of aspects that simple agrarian societies have found to revel in has yet another purpose than simply hedging one's bets. The more aspects one can appeal to, the stronger the magic will be. Thus, among the East and South Slavs, the bride was seated successively or simultaneously on the kneading trough, on furs, borrowed if necessary, with someone's baby boy on her knee, under the icon of the Mother of God, and so on, while she was ritually pelted with hops, coins, grain, comparable to our rice throwing, and in recent times, candy, and the marriage bed was made on top of sheaves of wheat and rye, and often in the barn among the fertile animals. All this was intended analogically to saturate her with hoped-for wealth and fertility. The more symbols and aspects of them, the better. The principle of multiple aspects spills over bounteously into ritual and magic. Individual objects used for ritual purposes presumably carried more efficacy if loaded with multiple symbols of such qualities as fertility. Thus, if a ritual towel or wedding bracelet has an ornamental design resembling at once a cloning hops vine and a woman in labor, and perhaps a frog, which in shape resembles a pregnant woman squatting with her legs spread for parturition, so much the better. The fertility magic will be the stronger for it. Hops recommend themselves as symbols of fertility by the masses of cone-shaped fruits they produce, by their adventitiousness, spreading quickly by underground runners as well as by seed, and by the speed with which the vine tips grow in the spring, clocked at sometimes 6 inches per day. Rural dress in East Europe, particularly that of brides, is similarly saturated with multiple symbols of fertility and protection encoded into color, design, placement, material, number, and anything else that can be drafted for the task. Thus, for example, red, life-affirming ornaments typically appear at the openings to the clothing to ward off the willful sickness demons that might otherwise climb in. Protective roses adorn the sleeves and fronts of both men's and women's shirts, while the women's carry in addition rows of lozenges for fertility. Lozenges come in two chief varieties, one with rays or hooks around it, representing the vulva, and the other with an X inside that divides it into four small lozenges, each with a dot inside. The latter is known as the sown field motif and is supposed to represent a field with plowed furrows, the interior lines, sown with seeds, the dots. Is sown field a late interpretation, cobbled up by or for anthropologists? No. The motif can be traced in East European art back through the centuries all the way to the Neolithic cultivators of East Europe, circa 4000 BC, when the Tripolye farmers, in today's Ukraine and Romania, made clay figurines of naked women, some of which have this design incised on the belly or buttocks. The dots in these cases were made by impressing actual grains of wheat into the clay, truly a sown field about to produce new life. Beliefs and their symbols, just like volcano myths, can survive 6,000 years. And longer. Until recently, women of childbearing age in this area wore a garment called a back apron. Prepubescent girls were not entitled to wear it. Donning it showed the community the girl had reached physical maturity and could be courted for marriage. Traditionally, it was woven in a square pattern, first depicted on female figurines in the late Neolithic and Bronze Ages, and often embellished for extra potency with the sown field motif and or the hooked lozenge. It also carried little pom-poms or fringes, remnants of a yet older tradition still in use from the Urals to the Adriatic, in the form of an apron nicknamed a string skirt. Like the squared back apron, the string skirt marked its wearer as a woman who had reached childbearing age, and it was still in use quite recently among the non-Indo-European Mordvins east of Moscow and among diverse groups in the Balkans, Slavs, Romanians, Greeks, Vlachs, Albanians. We can trace the string skirt back through the Iron Age, depicted in archaic and Hellenistic art, and mentioned by Homer, the Bronze and Neolithic Ages, preserved in graves and depicted on numerous figurines, all the way to the Gravettian Venus figures of 20,000 BC, some of whom wear such skirts over obviously mature female anatomy. If a belief system and its specific symbols can survive so staunchly for over 20,000 years, why not a myth? Chapter 8. Multiple Viewpoints. Ear, Trunk, or Tail. Mismatch Effect. The same real event reported by two different sources may be reported in wildly different forms, which may therefore seem unrelated at first glance. Another serious eddy generated by the multiplicity of possible views is that the same noteworthy event experienced by two different people or cultures may go down in history, oral or otherwise, in almost unrecognizably different forms, as the tellers fasten on to different aspects to report. The famous Sufi story of five blind men encountering different parts of the same elephant, trunk, ear, leg, and so forth, encapsulates this problem. Bearing the elephant feelers in mind, imagine that the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens, a well-documented natural event, as described by people A, on the mountainside, B, in the Tootle River Valley, C, in Portland, and D, in eastern Washington and Idaho. Group D, farthest away, did not see the actual eruption at 8:32 a.m., but experienced it soon afterwards as a choking blizzard of ash that blotted out the sun all day, covering everything inches deep in gritty, gray-white, lung-destroying powder, and making life as usual quite impossible for a while. In Yakima, Washington, 85 miles due east, National Geographic reported that midnight gloom arrived at 9:30 in the morning, and street lamps burned all day. In memory, it has become Black Sunday. It was more than blackness. It was blackness that hid the unknown. No headlights could cut it to reveal the stalled car ahead. Largely composed of fine volcanic glass particles, the cloud was itself a mass of cutting edges. For insects, the edges quickly abraded wax coatings and allowed vital body fluids to escape, dehydration and death. Some small creatures quickly choked. Larger creatures avoided suffocation but seemed disoriented. Like their neighbors, the Zirkles have grim memories of Black Sunday. The darkness came so fast there was no time to think about trying to run, even if we'd wanted to, Bill said. His wife, Pat, and the three children fled indoors, expecting the most horrendous thunderstorm of their lives. They were right, but it heralded ash instead of rain. And it was close, Bill said. So close you saw lightning and heard thunder almost at the same time. One bolt hit between me and a neighbor, jarred the ground. Volcanic ash clouds typically carry supercharged static electricity. 2 days after the eruption, the San Francisco Chronicle reported, in parts of eastern Washington, Idaho, and Montana, where as much as 6 inches of ash covered the ground in some places, the fallout forced the closing of schools, businesses, train stations, airports, and highways. In many areas, emergency shelters were set up to aid residents who had difficulty breathing and stranded motorists whose cars stalled with clogged air filters. The wind's blowing out of the trees like a blizzard, a police lieutenant said. The only things open are medical facilities, food stores, and emergency operations. You can't even drive in it. It's worse than driving on ice. The lieutenant said merchants who attempted to hose the ash off their sidewalks only managed to produce a gooey mud that's really slick. A man in Spokane said that it looked like the contents of a vacuum cleaner bag had been dumped on the city. A Morton, Washington resident said going out of doors was like sticking your head in the fireplace and stirring up the ashes. Group C had a ringside view of the eruption. Relatives telephoned us and described the towering pillar of smoke overshadowing their house that Sunday morning. A magnitude 5.0 earthquake and huge sound waves generated at the moment of explosion announced the proceedings. Even 200 miles away, the blast sounded like artillery, said a Washington resident. Our house was just shaking. A geological report described the pillar thus. In the air, boiling into the sky to an altitude of 65,000 to 80,000 feet, 20,000 to 25,000 meters, the volcano's vertical plume of gas, ash, steam, and dust trailed off to the northeast. Inside that tall plume could be seen strong convective upwelling currents, while stratus clouds were entrained or drawn in at several levels within the vertical column. At the same time, violent flashes of lightning were seen throughout the height of the column, and as the mushroom cap formed, it began expanding outward at an altitude of about 50,000 feet, 15,000 meters. But Portland, Oregon lay well beyond the path of the hot pyroclastics, and blessedly upwind of the ash cloud that engulfed much of Washington, Group D. Group B scrambled for their lives as a wall of thick, muddy, 90-degree water, laden with half-cooked trout and thousands of trees snapped off by the initial blasts, raced down the valley toward the sea. I could hear it crackling from my house. It was wall-to-wall logs, said a man living near the bottom of the mountain. San Francisco Chronicle, May 19, 1980. Most of Group A didn't live to tell what they saw, but the few who did struggled to describe things so extraordinary and horrific that sometimes only similes sufficed. A member of a tree-planting crew, at work on the foot of the mountain itself, only 3 miles from the summit on the south side, remembers the instant of stunned disbelief when the eruption began. There was no sound to it, not a sound. It was like a silent movie, and we were all in it. First the ash cloud shot out to the east, then to the west. Then some lighter stuff started shooting straight up. At the same time, I saw the ash curtains starting to come right down the south slope toward us. I could see boulders. They must have been huge, being hurled out of the leading edge. Northwest of the peak, some 14 miles away, a 4-man tree-thinning crew was caught by the blast. They tried to walk out, their scorched clothing sticking to burned skin. At Cougar, 12 miles southwest of St. Helens, Mort and Sandy Mortensen stared at the ash cloud devouring the sky. It just kept spilling over and turning darker, Sandy said, until all the daylight you could see was a long way off, and it looked like it was coming through a curtain. A geological report adds another scene. On the ground during the blast, too, a group of fishermen, trapped on the Green River, 16 miles, 26 kilometers, northeast of the peak, found themselves near the periphery of the devastated area. They were badly burned and survived only by jumping into the river when they first became aware of the explosion. They suffered burns, however, when they came up for air and when they left the protection of the water. The heat, they said, came in waves, over a period lasting perhaps 10 or 15 minutes. Now, place all these viewpoints into separate mythic traditions. Group D tells of the sun hiding its face for a long time in thick, palpable darkness, whereas Group B recounts a flood of unparalleled proportions drowning their world, and Group A speaks of unimaginable heat blasting from a mountain. Group C, for its part, talks in measured terms of a gigantic pillar of smoke, riddled with lightning, rising to the sky. Would we recognize these stories as the same event? Only, at best, after much careful piecing. Note that the clearest picture comes from the closest witnesses who did not suffer truly major damage, especially Group C. Those at Ground Zero are much too busy to analyze the big picture, while those too far away simply can't see much. Scholars who have worked on reconstructing the explosion of Thera, now dated by the geologists to about 1625 BC, may recognize the parallels to the above zone-by-zone descriptions of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. The two events are geologically similar, since both volcanoes contain very viscous lava that builds up to high-pressure explosions known as Pelean eruptions, after Mount Pelée in Martinique. But the eruptions differed greatly in size. For all the havoc of the Washington eruption, Thera blew out of itself many times as much debris, then abruptly collapsed into its own emptiness, like Mount Mazama. And because Thera is an island, the collapse allowed surrounding waters of the Aegean Sea to rush in, triggering major tsunamis as well. To study the myths generated by Thera, then, we must also arm ourselves with some recent descriptions of sea-girt explosions and tsunamis. Records of the massive 1883 eruption of Krakatoa, an island volcano in the straits between Java and Sumatra, provide helpful parallels. Several times bigger than Mount St. Helens, though smaller than Thera, its last and largest series of explosions was heard 2,200 miles to the east in Alice Springs, Australia, and 2,900 miles west at Rodriguez, an island most of the way to Madagascar. That is one loud noise. A captain sailing some 75 miles to the north entered into his ship's log, So violent are the explosions that the eardrums of over half my crew have been shattered. My last thoughts are with my dear wife. I am convinced that the day of judgment has come. The ash cloud from Krakatoa rose so high, variously calculated by captains at 17 to 21 miles, or over 90,000 feet, that it entered the stratosphere, where winds carried its debris around the world, causing cooler weather and gorgeous sunsets. Slowly descending to Earth, some of the detritus fell on the Greenland ice sheets, leaving a unique signature in the ice layers, layers that geologists can now count like tree rings. It was from such a signature, in fact, that scientists finally determined when Thera actually exploded. The thick ash cloud from Krakatoa also spread out in the Sunda Straits, so densely that nearby sailors, like the residents of Yakima, Group D, could see neither the sun nor each other. The government mail ship Loudon, having just managed to survive a triple tsunami that wiped away the town of Tolok Betong before the crew's very eyes, attempted to steam out of the bay that faced Krakatoa from the northwest. We hoped soon to be out of the Bay of Lampong, but we would not get away that easily. It became darker and darker, so that already at 10 a.m. there was the most Egyptian darkness. This darkness was complete. Usually on a dark night, one can still distinguish some outlines of, for instance, white objects. However, here a complete absence of light prevailed. The sun climbed higher and higher, but none of her rays reached us. Even on the horizon, not the faintest light could be seen. This darkness continued for 18 hours. The young son of the captain of the W.H. Bessie, a Boston ship just entering the straits from the southwest, recalled that the air seemed to be filled with dust, so much that we feared suffocation. It became black, so black you couldn't see your hand before your face. I've never imagined the atmosphere could be so dense. Flurries of lightning, bouts of St. Elmo's fire on the rigging, and occasional glimpses of fireballs on the volcano provided the only breaks in the blackness. Tidal waves crashed into the shore on both sides of the strait, killing over 36,000 people and uncounted numbers of animals. Group A. Owing to the darkness and terror, reliable observation of the height of the waves was almost impossible. They are thought to have reached 36 meters, 120 feet in places. The lighthouse keepers at Vlaki Hook, 88 kilometers away, recorded them at 15 meters, 50 feet high. Another quite reliable estimate is from Tolok Betong, where the water washed to within 2 meters of the top of a hill, 23 meters, 75 feet high. It was at this port that the gunboat Berolf, which had been moored in the harbor, was carried nearly 3 kilometers inland and left at 9 meters above sea level. In general, it may be safely reckoned that at distances of between 50 and 80 kilometers from the volcano, the waves averaged 15 meters high and that they tended to pile up much higher at the head of bays. From Luce, 1969. Under those ships sailing nearby in deep water as the eruption progressed, the tidal waves passed with less harm, since it is only in the shallows that such a wave gains height, while the sailors noted a confused sea with heavy squalls from different directions, or, as another captain put it, squalls, storms, and seas as high as the heavens. Ships like the Loudon and the Bessie, however, that were steaming through shallow water, had to use all their seamanship to survive, dropping both anchors with all available chain, then steering straight into the oncoming walls of water. On the Loudon, the first tremendous wave came moving in from the sea, which literally blocked the view and moved with tremendous speed. One moment, and the wave had reached us. The ship made a tremendous tumbling. The wave now reached Tolok Betong and raced inland. The light tower could be seen to tumble. The houses disappeared. The steamer Berolf was lifted and got stuck, and everything had become sea in front of our eyes, where a few minutes ago Tolok Bitong Beach had been. During a brief lull, the Loudoun attained somewhat deeper water, but at the cost of moving closer to the volcano. Soon its men had to start clearing the decks of hot rocks that fell thick and fast. While we were engaged in this struggle and enveloped in the sheer blackness of a veritable hell, a new and terrible danger came upon us. This was the approach of the tidal wave caused by the final eruption, which occurred about 12:30 to 1 p.m. The wave reached us at 2 p.m. or thereabouts and made the ship tumble like a seesaw. Sometimes she was almost straight on end. At other times she heaved over almost on her beam ends. We were anchored and steaming up to our anchors as before. The captain was lashed with three ropes along the engine room companionway, while I, the second engineer, was lashed down below to work the engines. The captain was later awarded a governmental gold medal for his heroism and skill in saving the mail ship and its passengers. Farther away, the Bessie experienced the tidal waves as a current beyond anything you can imagine, a current like a mill race running by the ship, to such an extent that we thought the vessel would either drag its anchors or pull its bow out of the ship. As for what being hit by a tidal wave on land is like, we must extrapolate from reports of little tsunamis, like a mere 4 to 5 footer that hit near Hilo, Hawaii, immediately after a nearby 7.2 earthquake in 1975. A young man camping on the beach recounts, "I saw the wave coming, and it hit us, and I was in the swirling water. We couldn't even stand up. I've lived in Hawaii all my life, but no quake was like this one. We fell to our hands and knees." There were several tidal waves. The first one came up onto the beach only about 25 yards. We all ran inland. The second wave hit me and dragged me 50 yards. After it subsided, I got up and ran more until I came to a crevasse about 10 feet deep and 8 feet wide. I looked back and saw Dr. Mitchell and yelled, "Do you need help?" He had a shocked look on his face. Then the big one came, and I was in the swirling water fighting to breathe. I became unconscious. The last thing I remember is fighting to get my breath. I'll never forget that sound, the sound of the wave coming. Then it slams into your body and you just fly. These images are echoed by one of the few survivors of Krakatoa's lashing of the Sumatra coast. The controller at Binawang wrote of the terrible noise of each tidal wave as it rushed in. After the second wave demolished his hilltop home, he says, "I got hold of a few pieces of thin wood and managed to stay afloat until the water returned to the sea, and I felt solid ground under my feet. Suddenly, the water returned with the same force. The water took hold of me and turned me around and threw me away with a terrible force." When finally beached again, he found all his clothes had been ripped off, and he was so exhausted he could not move for at least an hour, despite the constant rain of lava mud. Now, let us return to the eruption of Thera, which occurred in the Middle Bronze Age, in the heart of a long-inhabited area. This was such a huge event that it cannot have gone unnoticed by those living around it, nor can it have been deemed unimportant. In fact, quite a number of interesting accounts have survived in the mythologies of surrounding peoples. The Minoans were living in Crete, 70 miles south, and the Mycenaean Greeks had recently moved in next door on the Greek mainland to the northwest, setting up major centers at places such as Mycenae and Tiryns, and infiltrating long-standing pre-Hellenistic settlements like Athens. The Hittites, another partly literate group, had just set up their kingdom in central Anatolia, Turkey, to the east. If literate peoples controlled the Aegean shore of Turkey, we do not have their texts. How we divide these populations into zones A, B, C, and D to understand their camera angles will depend, of course, on the circumstances of the eruption. Archaeological evidence shows that Thera came to life with enough serious preliminary grumblings that the residents packed their valuables, stowed their other goods neatly in their basements, and got off the island. For quite unlike Pompeii and Herculaneum, which lie at the foot of Vesuvius in Italy, Thera and its excavations have produced no bodies. Group A, wipeout. Then the volcano blew its heart out in an immense column of fiery rock and ash. But as the center emptied, the sides began to crack, letting surrounding seawater into the superheated interior, a particular hazard of island volcanoes. The mix vaporized so violently that it blew out nearly half the rim and created fierce tsunamis in the lateral directions of these forces. When the pyrotechnics subsided and the ash cloud cleared away, where once a mountain had stood, lay a huge crater that still today drops sheer from the shattered rim, 1,000 feet to sea level, and another 1,000 straight down to the sea floor. At the site now called Akrotiri, quakes snapped entire stone staircases, and the intense base surge blasting out from the initial eruption scoured colorful murals off the facing house walls, while lava bombs smashed down random buildings, and the mounting weight of ash broke through the roofs, catching the falling household objects in a thick white cushion before they hit the floor, in a three-dimensional time capsule. It buried the whole under more than 100 feet of ash, called tephra in its deposited form, tossing out many cubic kilometers of pulverized rock. We know from the pattern of traceable fallout that winds pushed the ash cloud largely to the southeast, across central and eastern Crete, Group D, while tsunamis slammed into the surrounding shores, Group B, leaving a bathtub ring of pumice on nearby islands, wrenching aside huge wall stones at the Minoan harbor of Amnissos on the north shore of Crete, and causing characteristic underwater landslides in a wide swath across the Mediterranean floor. The Greeks, and anyone else living in Attica and Euboea, barely north of the ashfall, would have had the best ringside seat, Group C. From just that area, shortly after the invention of the Greek alphabet, and hence just at the end of the oral pipeline, we have a typical Group C description of a catastrophic event. As you hear this epic passage from the early Greek poet Hesiod's poem, The Theogony, The Birth of the Gods, keep in mind the willfulness and movie construct principles. It purports to describe the gods, beneficent spirits, closing in battle with some upstart giants, nasty spirits, in this case, the race of Titans,